I think it's important early on just to understand that disability is not a homogenous construct. There are people with mobility disabilities, whether they're wheelchair users or use crutches or some other mobility aid. Those with vision impairment or who are blind, hearing impairment or who are deaf. Those with cognitive disabilities, those with learning disabilities. There's a whole gamut. And of those people, there's also differing levels of support needs. So for a lot of people with disability, they don't need extra supports to participate. But for those people that do, there's a compounding of barriers that just make things a lot harder. So if we take one that a lot of people will be familiar with, somebody like myself who uses a power chair, there are some transport issues because we can't use standard vehicles, require modified vehicles. Modified vehicles are a lot more expensive. Or if you're not able to use public transport, then you use paratransit, wheelchair accessible vehicles. And while there's a government subsidy of 50% up to $120, that's still a pretty expensive way to travel. And of course, in places like Sydney, it's a big geographic space. And disability sports aren't in all areas. They tend to be concentrated in certain areas. And there's in the recreation area, there's a concept called distance decay. Basically, the further you are away from a facility or activity, the less likely you are to use it. And again, equipment's expensive, depending on the sport you choose. Are you a cyclist?
No, I'm not. I'm terrible at it.
Depending on the style of cycling you're in, you know, your bike could be anything from 500 to 20,000. And similarly, depending on the sports with disability that you're in, you've got those costs. Plus, in the disability area, there seems to be a price gouging that goes on with specialist equipment. So it's that extra problem. And of course, if you are using the taxi transport subsidy scheme, which is a wonderful scheme in many ways, it's still an expensive way to travel. And if you're on a pension or your family's got a number of children, then it becomes very, very costly to participate on a regular basis if you have to travel for it.
So what is the alternative to that? Is there an alternative?
This is where, when we look at sport development pathways, if you're a person without a disability, you can pretty much join a local club. Or there might be unorganised activities in your area. It's all pretty close. But for people with disabilities where those activities aren't close, then those barriers actually don't give them the benefits of being involved in sport. And one of the things we found, whether somebody's a grassroots participant, just doing stuff for fun, the thing that's common from the grassroots to the elite level is the sense of belonging that's created. So you don't feel you're on your own. You're part of something bigger. There's all these other people that are going through the same stuff, particularly if it's age group or whatever. Sports and clubs become very family-like. And where you're not able to access that, that means that there's a really important part of life that other Australians are getting access to that you're not. So you're more isolated. You have feelings that isolation affects your mental well-being. And also you're not getting all the health benefits that are associated with sport as well.
In addressing these barriers, how do you kind of bridge this divide? Or what is a tactic to democratise it, for lack of a better word?
Well, one of the things that a number of organisations have been successful at doing, from either the grassroots right through to the elite level, is to promote more inclusive practice. And that's by offering training programs that give coaches, volunteers, others involved in the sporting family an understanding of some really simple things to do to make their sport more inclusive across the spectrum of not just disability, but you can throw in Indigenous, people from different ethnic backgrounds, so that sport becomes more representative of those in the community of where they're living.
And how would you get, say, a coach to be more inclusive? Is it in the language? Is it in the actual sport practice itself?
Again, one of the things that comes across, not just in the sport area, but positive can-do attitude. So rather than going, oh, computer says no, and one of the other thing we do need to acknowledge is, you know, 70% of all sports are fully run by volunteers. So a lot of people think of, you know, the professional competitions in the AFL, netball, FFA, but, you know, the clubland is exclusively by volunteers who have all sorts of pressures on them. Some regional associations, state associations and national associations are making it easy by offering training programs and giving the resources to make the transition to be a more inclusive community sport for people of different abilities.
Do you think that would also go to try, like, in a way to bring down the wall when it comes to sport? Because for me, even when I was growing up, I was very intimidated by, you know, sports players, the idea of going to like a club or anything like that. Do you think implementing those programs or kind of changing the language could kind of strip it down a little bit and make it a little bit more inviting for, I guess, anybody?
Yeah, it's a really interesting observation you have, because even, you know, there's many stories of nightmares that people have had from their PE teachers at school or local coaches who didn't understand that, you know, maybe the under 10 netball team just want to have a bit of fun and put the ball through the hoop and not aspire to be national champions, you know, within their first season. You know, belonging is around the sociability of sport. So, okay, you win, you lose, but, you know, you have a nice social occasion that goes with it. So I'm really sorry that that was your experience when you were younger, because, you know, it shouldn't be. It should be a welcoming environment that seeks to skill people up to undertake challenges that are matched to their abilities at the time. And that's a really good pointer for people with disability or without disability, because if you haven't done activities, you just can't get thrown into it. You've actually got to learn stuff.
And I guess that is an interesting point to raise. It's for someone who might live with a disability and want to engage in a particular sport, not necessarily having to go to a designated facility that would cater for someone with a disability, perhaps when there is a mix of, I guess, the general population. What is the process of bridging that divide?
The Australian Sports Commission has a spectrum called the inclusion spectrum. And the inclusion spectrum, you might have a disability-specific sport, and there's nothing wrong with a disability-specific sport, and you might end up at the Paralympics doing wheelchair rugby or goalball for people that are blind. And then there's integrated sport. That's sports where people with disability and those without disability play together. And we're seeing some interesting ones that are on the disability side. So we've got some of the adapted rugby league includes both people with disability and those without disability playing in a similar comp in their wheelchair area, and then a more mixed nature in other versions of rugby league, right up to power wheelchair level. Right. And then you've got fully inclusive sport. There's a lady who is a table tennis player that plays in both the Olympic and the Paralympic teams. And the other area that I think most sports can do a lot of work on is this idea of the sporting family. So that is the officials, whether that be referees, club officials in managing teams, doing behind-the-scenes support, being involved in setting up the tuck shop, sorting out the on-field pads and line marking, doing the refereeing. These are all things that even if you're, you know, not at a fighting fit participation way, you can still get the benefits of being involved in clubs.